So tonight we talk about the Siddha tradition, which we touched upon last time, and as it continued into the Natha Yoga tradition, the Natha Siddhis, and finally into Hatha Yoga. And there is a very strong linkage among these, which date back 1,000 years. When last we spoke, we were speaking about Abhinavagupta, who had taken all the available strands of Indian knowledge at that point, including Vedanta, knowledge of the ancient Vedic and Vedantic scriptures, along with all the tantric teachings, the Kaula school, the Krama school, the Vama school, everything that was around, he brought into his own being and synthesized it and wrote about it in aesthetic terms, which were wonderful. If you read his Sanskrit, it's probably the best Sanskrit you'll ever read anywhere. It is mellifluous, it is powerful. And as he speaks to you, he lifts you into the experience that he represents in the words. So such a teaching, you know, speaking of the beauty of the world. And this is the substance of the Tantra, is that the world is real. The world is genuine, is valid. And even in those aspects of tantric practice, which seem to lay stress on Shiva, always you find that the element of Shakti really dominates when it comes down to the core practice, to the methods used, to the rituals engaged. We spoke about Abhinavagupta, but a few decades before, there was another great teacher, and Abhinavagupta is listed among the inheritors of that tradition, of which he was only the ninth in line, and that was Goraksha, known in Hindi as Goraknath. Nath means Lord. He was recognized as being a Siddha, one who is perfected. And that idea of perfection, we need to stop and look at for a moment, because the root word for that is Siddh, which comes from the same root as Sadh. So it means to realize, to perfect, to fulfill, just as sadhana is a straight path that takes you towards the goal, becomes in our lingo spiritual discipline, spiritual practice. It means that which will take you there, really, huh? And just so, the practice that leads to siddha leads you to perfect fulfillment. Now, the fulfillment that we have been witnessing again and again throughout the Indian tradition is this elevation of consciousness into a rapturous communion with a supreme reality. But we have seen in some of the Upanishads, for instance, in a few of the Vedic citations that we looked at from the Rig Veda, that there is an idea in India of the bodily ascension, the lifting of the physical frame itself into perfection, into perhaps immortality. And the Siddha tradition indeed aims at that as much as it is aiming at conscious immortality. It is aiming at making the body indestructible. Vajra. And this will place itself in the Buddhist tradition as well. The idea that the body must participate kind of goes along with this. The idea that the body is itself perfectible. If the divine is omnipresent, lives in all things in a sense are figurations of that being, then would it not be possible for that physical frame to take on the characteristics of that Godhead? And in the practice of the Tantra, and then in the Siddha tradition that develops from the Tantra, that idea gets brought to front and center. And the ideal of the seeker there is to become a second Shiva, and utilizes all the being to engage in that. Not some of the being, not trying to tie down and wrestle the consciousness free from the imprisoning body, but using the body and the life energies in it and the mental focus proper to it to channel the aspiration upwards until communion is attained. And what is it that carries one upwards but that conscious power that's at the base of the universe, which we know as Kundalini? Yes, there is the idea that the Kundalini, which lies coiled and asleep at the base of the body, is in a sense an involution of a greater power, a conscious Kundali, Mahakundali above, which transposes itself and deposits its force in this apparently sleeping vehicle and can be awakened. And so that one is really attaining union of the Kundalini, sleeping below as a coiled serpent power, with the uncoiled supreme infinite consciousness Mahakundali above. But more typical is the idea that the Kundalini will rise and attain union with Shiva, so that Shakti and Shiva, power and conscious being, are reunited. Now, we've been speaking about the Sankhya Yoga all along and how the terms that it uses to describe the construction of the world, of Prakriti, the play of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, go into the construction of everything from top to bottom. This is carried over into this tradition as well. It was there, obviously, before the Vedantic tradition. It predates Vedanta. It is probably indigenous to India. Who knows how old it is? But the idea that Prakriti is a living, conscious reality is not part of the systematic Sankhya that we eventually get in schoolbook form, but it is probably just as she was recognized as being in the original. Because what is Prakriti in the Siddha tradition, in the Tantra tradition, is Shakti. Prakriti is Shakti. Shakti is not absent of consciousness, although the word means power. It is consciousness as power, so always carries consciousness in it. We met that last week in Abhinavagupta in Kashmir Shaivism, where consciousness is Chit Shakti. It has an inherent power within it. So the universe that we've seen all along, which is multi-leveled in the Sankhya, taken into the Upanishads, repeated in the Bhagavad Gita, is still with us now when we get here. But all those various planes of the universe are specifically connected in this teaching to the presence of centers of consciousness within us, the various chakras. And just as there are five elements, there are five chakras and a sixth at the top that leads to the experience of the infinite. And so, if Kundalini is asleep at the bottom, then it has to be stirred awake. awakened somehow and made to rise and penetrate level after level. And it is this idea of penetration, Veda, V-E-D-H-A, which is crucially important in the teaching of the Siddhas and will become so in the teaching of the Nats and will become so in the teaching of Hatha Yoga. Because everything that goes into the practice of spiritual life is meant to force our sleeping energies into wakeful, rapturous communion with what is the Godhead, with what is the divine. Nothing can be left behind. And as you've probably heard, you know, the practice of the early tantras and the practice of the siddhas was not afraid of confronting sexual energy any more than it was afraid of confronting appetite for food or appetite for rest, the need to sleep, and forcing the body to be awake, forcing it to become adamantine, forcing it to use its weaknesses and predilections towards this or that into elements of strength. And in fact, it seizes upon these very elements to transform them, to take the sexual energies, which were rather freely exchanged in the original tantra, in the original teaching of those schools, the masculine and the feminine conjunction was the means by which, not just metaphorically, but even physically, one could arrive at these high states of bliss. In fact, we find in the tantras that these efforts are replicated from one to the other. In the erotico-mystical practice of tantra, we find that idea of polar energies being connected, transposed in the practice of yoga, where we try to use the physical and the emotional and the vital energies to achieve the same thing through controlling posture and controlling breath. But there is a third element, little noticed, which is the rasayana technique, which is alchemical, where you actually use heavy metals, as it were, metallurgical science, to try to arrive at a means by which you can turn the lead into gold, the lead of the bodily experience into the gold of the spiritual. And so the Siddha tradition that Goraksha started was carried forward into the Natha Siddhas, who probably come into being a couple of hundred years after his life. And they're using all three techniques. Where the tantrics might have used ritualized sex, at least in part, to achieve their aims, the siddhas, as reconstituted as the Nat siddhas, use the tantric ritual, use the postures which are coming into being by then, many, many postures, and also alchemical techniques, all in a sort of a pincer movement to drive the aspirant completely into that state. So, if Goraksha is 10th century, and the Nat Siddhas come along in, say, around the 12th century, using the Goraksha Padati as one of their principal texts, it's still a few hundred years later before we get to the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, the manual on the forceful technique. But again, this is forceful. It is used, hatha, we say, means forceful. It can also mean violent. And just as these other experiences are explosive and aim at exploding you out of your ordinary awareness into a supramundane awareness where all contraries are annihilated and there is only the sense of union, just so in the practice of Hatha Yoga, this would have been aimed at. Let me just, if I may, read a verse or two to you from some of these ancient documents. So last week we were in the 10th century, and we start tonight with Goraksha in the 10th century. Let's go now, a couple of centuries later. These are words attributed to him, but we don't know that he ever actually wrote anything. But this is a received teaching, and several hundred years before Hatha Yoga comes into being, literally Hatha Yoga comes into being. So, Goraksha is talking, we guess, and he says, of all the postures, two are special. The first is said to be the perfect posture, Siddhasana. The second is the lotus posture, Kamala Asana. Now, in the first, you put one foot down, you put the other heel on top of that, and you press your chin against the Hridaya Chakra, here, down like that, so that you're sitting with your hands on your knees and your chin fixed, immovable. Your gaze is forward. And then, with your senses restrained, this goes back to the old yogic idea that actually predates even Patanjali, that one of the things that you have to do in the practice of anything, and this is what yoga originally meant, is restraint. Harness those energies, pull them into alignment. Get a grip on those reins, control those horses. So the senses get restrained. He should gaze steadily at the Ajna Chakra. That is, Ajna means command. Chakra means center or circle. So it's literally the command center. It's where you apply your will and command things. So here you're saying, no, there's not going to be any stirring. All of these energies are going to be held just like this. That's the perfect posture. And then, just as you open a door with a key, so the yogin should break open the door to liberation by means of the Kundalini. So through use of the breath, by cupping the hands firmly, assuming this posture, placing the chin tightly against the chest, and with the mind, the chetas, in meditation, he should expel again and again the apana, the air which comes from above, pushing it up, having filled the chest with it, push it up, and then releasing the life force, he acquires an unequaled understanding, an enlightenment, a buddha, through the awakening of the shakti. So you can see what's happening. There is this penetration. Now, there's this idea that the tantrics originally had of this combination of sexual fluids somehow being lifted up. And in the lifting, the Kundalini energy would glide upward and reach this communal status with Shiva above. So it's the reverse polarity. There, instead of the male's energy going upwards into the vaginal canal, this is the idea of the Kundalini energy traveling upwards in the male, like the woman power, the female power, is going up and achieving that. But in any case, this idea of penetration that's caused by the Kundalini breaks through all these circles, these areas which represent different powers of consciousness in us. So there is first the explosion of the physical orientation. We are thrown into a world where we feel physically that all is one. And then we barrel through the various vital fields, those which control our appetites for food, which control our appetites for concord, for amity, for love. Give us the power to speak. Give us the power to see, to envision, until suddenly every aspect of us is living in a thrilling identity with the awakened universe. And as the universe becomes, in a sense, awake to us, we are awakening the universe. There's an effect that the individual achievement has upon the world around. And so there is a gladdening of all through the rising of the aspirant in this increasing illumination as Kundalini reaches towards the final state where there is a non-dual duality. It isn't that Shakti and Shiva become part of a homogenized jug of milk. They retain power and consciousness capacity, but they are bi-yun. They are the same thing. As if equals become one without erasing each other. And that's what happens to us. But the not siddhas, the kanpatas, won't rest with that, nor did the tantrics, because you can't simply have that experience of what is above without returning with it, because it is cyclic. This polarity continues. So now the divine consciousness comes down and cements itself in the awakened body. That round of profound experience is assimilated. And then it begins again. Up one goes again. Now, with the not siddhas, they would be practicing all of these things in an order which only they would understand. But the lineage of the guru and the responsibility of the guru in making this happen for the aspirant was critically important. Even in the Kulanava Tantra, we find a description of the guru as being 16 in number, and many are the ways of initiation. Sometimes they only think of you and you're initiated. And sometimes they have to give you deep instruction. It depends on the nature of the aspirant as to what has to happen. But finally what happens is that the guru enters into the disciple and stirs the Kundalini herself or himself. Not all gurus are men. Some gurus are women. And so this whole process begins. The power, the grace of the guru starting it. Now the lineage of the not siddhas, N-A-T-H, continues to this day. Of the main schools of the tantra sadhanas, almost none remain. Only Sri Vidya is still powerful today. We may talk about that next week. The rasayana practitioners, gone like the wind. But the not-siddhas, who were not interested in simply having a transcendental experience of the divine, but interested in what you do with it here, were quite interested in the social ramifications and in the political ramifications of what happened when you got that consciousness. And in fact, came to influence certain kingdoms in Nepal and in the 19th century in Rajasthan. Man Singh was a disciple of one who followed in Goraknath's tradition. And in fact, turned over 1/10 of all that was taxed from his people to the Nats. And they spent it lavishly on temples and all sorts of things that they liked. And finally, as anybody will know who has read about the British incursion into India, there was a sad ending to the Nat dominance of Rajasthan. But the idea that spirituality should not be divorced from life has been made real in the past. It should also be noted that as much as we call for these great ascetics to come down from the mountains and take up the daily practice of life, when they do come down, they don't seem to be any better at it really than the other people. Because there's something about when you come down from the mountain, you lose your transcendence. And you become one of the guys like everybody else. And so after some time, society begins to look at you as just like one of the guys. So the Nats have continued to this day. We can't really say that Hatha Yoga has not continued, but as one person who is not a member of the Hatha Yoga community said very caustically a couple of decades ago, yes, Hatha Yoga can lead you to realization. It led one person to realization, Goraksha, and none after. If you're assigning an expectation that Hatha Yoga has to achieve what Vedanta achieves, it still sounds unkind. Hatha Yoga, by virtue of its own manual, the Hatha Pradipika, as we now know to call it instead of Hatha Yoga Pradipika, because if you look at all the oldest manuscripts, it's simply called Hatha Pradipika. Not even bothered to enter the term yoga in it. Hatha practice, in its very nature, aims at preparing the being for a mightier brand of yoga. It is aiming not at the most salutary states of yogic consciousness itself, but recognizing that the adhara, the jar, has to be made fit for the practice of yoga. And so in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, you know, you begin with the asana. You proceed to pranayama. You then learn what are the mudras. And then finally, you gain accession to the higher states of consciousness. And this is perfectly in keeping with exactly what the rest of these traditions are aiming at. All of them aim at stirring this kundalini energy, right? This nascent power of consciousness, which is universally present, but is sleeping because it's not aware of itself anymore. And so we have to become aware of it, energize it, make it rise. So this is precisely what Hatha Yoga does by forcing upon the body a kind of fixity, a one-pointedness the body assumes an asana. And potentially there was one. Goraksha liked two, especially. But here in Hatha Yoga, a number are described. Not 84, not, what is it, 84 lakhs that are potentially doable. And in fact, Goraksha says, for every type of life being upon earth, there is an asana. So they are limitless, literally. You find an asana that's natural to you, or which becomes natural to you, you learn how to hold it, and in it is a secret. Because the asana is where you seat your consciousness. And if you can assume even an extravagant posture, but your consciousness does not move, then you have become master of that and of all asanas. So, the asana means that the body experiences oneness through stability. It becomes the base of all things, the foundation, the floor, the first level upon which the temple will be built. But then you have to energize it, and that is what pranayama is aimed at doing. Not simply through the practice of the breath, taking it through the chandra and expelling it through the surya, taking it through the surya, expelling it through the chandra, eventually beginning to waken from the ida and pingala, the sushumna nadi, as it goes upwards and upwards and upwards to unite above. But it has to become vast. It has to become powerful. And however many breaths there are, whether there's an in-breath or an out-breath, it becomes one breath. The recognition, again, is in the rhythm of the rise and the fall, that there is no interruption, and that the consciousness simply moves with it. And can spontaneously arrest itself. And yet the breath continues, because the breath is not the rising and the falling. The breath is the power of prana, which we glibly translate as the life force, but it is much more than that. It is power itself. And if you become aware of this power and master of it, then you can send it in every direction. You can send this energy into the mind and make it glow like the sun, prakasha. You can send it into the sinews of the body and you will become lustrous. You can put it into the bones and the bones become unbreakable. You can extend it into the ashtasiddhis, the eight fulfillments. But we refine that power when we get to the mudras. And the mudras are divine gestures. These are gestures that we don't simply learn to do, that we assume a particular posture and then extend our hand in this way or whatever. No, when the gods begin to find in you an adaptable vehicle, they are always watching. And these conscious powers descend and fix themselves in you, and spontaneously, sahaja, you become vested with that. You become regal. You become kingly. You become like a lion. You become like an elephant. You become unstoppable. You become a god on earth. You become a second Shiva. So, all of this is simply the preparation of the vehicle. Now, one has to take the consciousness there. And that's what the fourth phase of the Hatha Yoga practice aims at. And where it says again and again, we are just trying to get to what the aim of Raja Yoga is. We're just trying to get to, well, frankly, its whole methodology is tantric. It's completely borrowed from the tantric and Siddha lineage. But they're trying to get back to this idea that Raja Yoga, being the kingly path, is what we have to be like. I think to maintain continuity with where it begins is really where Hatha Yoga needs to be, because there are no historical connections back to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, but there are very definite, vital, and historical connections back to the Tantra Yoga, back to the Siddha Yoga. So I would encourage all Hatha Yogins to get back to that. And by the way, it should be obvious to anybody who reads the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, or the Goraksha Padati, or the Shiva Samhita, or the Garanda Samhita. These are all the four primary texts of Hatha Yoga practice. That the idea is that you practice this in a cool area. All of these practices originated in the Himalayas. There is no such thing as Hatha Yoga. There is Hatha Yoga, there is no hot yoga. There is an emphasis on taking these one asana at a time. This business about vinyasa, linking of the asanas in this calisthenic order, as much as we love it, and I love it too, is not Hatha Yoga practice. No, you get into an asana and you maintain it. You stay in it. Four breaths? That's laughable. That's a beginning. Some hours. Go back through these documents and read what they expect you to be able to do. In there is a term, pala, which is a unit of measurement, which in the practice of Hatha Yoga means how long you're able to hold your breath. And they're expecting you to be able to essentially suspend your breath in kumbhaka for hours, for days, for weeks, for months. And the longer you can do it, the more godlike you become. Pala in alchemy, in the Rasayana practice, has the idea of weight. So how much mercury needs to be combined in calcinated form with something else that you can then swallow and ingest, and the more and more mercury that you can take into yourself, the more your physical flesh becomes lustrous, radiant. Now, I'm not going to teach you any Rasayana because I'm not having anybody playing with mercury. So that's as far as we're going. But the idea is, again, that we extend ourselves. This is no rapid fire practice. Hatha Yoga should not be rapid fire. It should be a settling in of the power of the mind, the power of the prana, the capacity of the body to sustain itself in conjoined oneness. And this allows everything to experience this penetration of the kundalini as it rises. You can imagine, if the kundalini is trying to rise and one part of you is agitated, is in a state of unrest, the wisest thing for the kundalini to do is to turn around and go back, because it knows that if it pushes up, everything explodes. But once you release the kundalini force, pew, it's on its way. So there are some yogic practices, and Sri Aurobindo's is one, where it is not the ascent of the kundalini which is aimed at, but the descent of the mahakundali. Remember we mentioned that? Taking that origination of the conscious power from above and bringing it down level by level, and as it comes with peace first, and then with power and light, and ultimately with Ananda, so one doesn't get washed away in bliss. And if it needs to pause, it pauses, because again, it's super conscient. It can see everything going on below. So as it descends, it settles in and massages the higher consciousness into part after part, parcel after parcel of our being, until it reaches the root base, the Muladhara chakra. That also is not the end. There are levels of stationed being below that, leading from the subconscient down into the inconscient. Goraksha originally talked about 9 centers, 9 chakras, Navachakra, not the 5 or 6 that we count. So they're really wherever you want to place them, because consciousness is a continuum. You know, what is the division point between the physical and the vital? What is the division point between the vital and the mental? What's the division point between the emotional being and the rational being? Do we really have to point that here at the throat? Might there not be innumerable places that you can find conjunctions between these forces? So it's a matter of practice. So those with a mystical experience are far more in tune with the rising of the energy and where it goes than with the fixity. All this iconography, this many lotuses, this many circles, etc., that is not universally experienced. But what is experienced is the swooping, the sweeping, the vastness of this power as it rises and expands and lifts us from our ordinary state of divided ignorance into unified knowledge, from patchwork experience of the world into oceanic bliss. It's worth the trip, and it's worth the risks. As Sri Aurobindo says somewhere in his writings on yoga, nobody can practice a yoga that doesn't put you at some risk. There is some danger in the practice of yoga. You might be introduced to an energy that you're not ready for. But if, on the other hand, you have to continue to live as the ordinary human lives, in thrall to the commoditization of life, always small, always in want, always about to suffer, if not in the act of suffering, then why not risk it? Why not gamble a little? So, I realize I've been going on and on. It's an infinite subject. I think next week we should come back and talk about the Sri Vidya school of Tantra Yoga, because it attempts a synthesis of the highest tantric teachings with Vedanta. And it continues today. You see it every time you see the Sri Vidya, the Sri Chakra, the Yantras, etc. You're looking at the material from the Sri Vidya school. So, if you have any questions.